This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. I'm very excited, very thrilled, you know, that we launched this program here at the Commonwealth Club with John Zipper, who's my co-host. Usually every Thursday afternoons, we do the taping of the podcast here. But we got a special treat, all thanks to Scott Walton over at SHN for hooking us up with this special, special, incredible afternoon, this Wednesday afternoon with all four of this amazing talent. There's so much talent here, and I don't know if we're going to have a conversation or they're just going to combust into a cosmic ball of energy that brings us all up to heaven and drops us off as their prodigies.
That's what we're going to do.
That's the plan. Yeah.
Well, I know most of you, you know, we know all four of them, and so I won't take up too much time in reading their bios, because that'll just be all afternoon. So I'll introduce them one by one. The great Pulitzer Prize-winning, Tony Award-winning James Lapine. Choreographer of Falsettos here with us, Spencer Liff. Producer, Falsettos, and many others. You can, you know, Google it all, but I think for the purpose of today's talk, we're talking about Falsettos, so Jordan Roth. And also, composer and the original of Falsettos, William Finn, the great William Finn. Bill. And you know my co-host, John Zipper.
Who has never won a Tony Award.
Well, yeah. So Falsettos, a groundbreaking musical that features or talks about a modern contemporary Jewish family. Marvin, a gay man, leaves his wife Trina, and we go through the complexities of human relationships between his young son, Jason, and his lover or partner, Wizard, and his psychiatrist, Myrtle. And we have the creators here, so I thought, you know, we'll just go there, and we'll start with Bill over on the other end.
Unfortunate, but go ahead.
Oh, great.
I mean, I think that, you know, if you've seen the revival in 2015, and even if you saw it in the first production on Broadway, you might not be very clear on how it all started. So I think starting with you is appropriate.
Many years ago, I just got out of Williams College, and I was calling myself a writer and not writing. And so I invited a few friends over to my house, Allison Fraser and Mary Test and Kay Pesek. And I said, just sing these songs, cook some chicken wings, which I'll buy, because I had no money. That was the only thing I could afford. And we started singing these songs, and about 2 months later, I said, why don't we make a show? So they said, sure. And so we invited people over. I borrowed chairs from the temple across the street, and we made a show.
But it wasn't this show.
And it was In Trousers, which, and Playwrights Horizons, the place where it was done, they said, we like you. We want to control your life. And so They gave me money and applied for grants for me, and then they commissioned me to write a show, which turned into March of the Falsettos, and that's how it started.
When did you know what story you wanted to tell in these?
Until Lapine told me. I didn't know before then.
I mean, was it that much of a collaboration, or did
No, it was that much of a collaboration. There was a bulletin board, a cork bulletin board, and we put notes on it, and eventually they told a story. you know, we had the song. We had a few songs. We stuck the songs there, and then we said, let's write a song about this. Let's write a song about that. Let's write a song about that. And James said, I work well with children. Why don't you put a child in it? And he became the center of the show. The show revolved around the child. And he directed it brilliantly, unbelievably brilliantly. So,
James, that's pretty high praise.
Yeah. Bill, what can I say but thank you? Yeah, I mean, it was a puzzle piece is what we did, because Bill had written a few songs and had these characters in mind, and then I kind of brought with these index cards, it kind of solved itself, because it was all, if you don't know the show, it's all sung through.
No, it solved itself if you're a logical thinker, which he is and I'm not. So that's why it solved itself.
Okay.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I'm speechless, actually. Well, on the board, you know, it became like, well, this one had a song, and this one had a song, and they had a song, and so this one hasn't had a song, so we'll put them there. And then you had to, the story was almost kind of built a little backwards in its way, because we had to figure out how to routine. It was only five people in the first act, so that's actually a bit of a challenge to actually do an hour, 15-minute show with five people and to figure out what numbers are group numbers, what are solo numbers, what does each of them have to say, what's the dramatic impulse, how are we going to end it. And it kind of came what's nice about it was back in a time when nonprofit theater actually would just give you a room and money and time, and they said, here, 4 weeks, make a show. We made a show. They invite the New York Times, gets a rave review, and suddenly you have a career. So that's kind of what happened.
Lucked How out. Hard is that?
Just add water.
Yeah, make it. Or
it doesn't happen amazing. Anymore, is, right. I guess, the point, sadly.
I, you know, seeing the revived version, and was not there for the 1992 original version, but the storylines are still very similar to the same. And one of the things that I picked out of that, I mean, now in 2019, we can talk about a lot of LGBTQ issues being out, being liberated, but I was very surprised by it not just being LGBTQ focus, but many of these issues that we would be closeted about, and not just about the identity. I mean, you know, a father comes out to his wife, comes out to his child, enter the psychiatrist, which many people would think is extremely, you know, there's some taboo in that. Mm-hmm. And then, so to tell these stories during that time,
yeah, I think it's.
I almost kind of would say, what were you thinking? I mean, were you like, this is, we're going to change the way people tell stories right here,
no,
right now?
But I was very conscious about trying not to write a show about how painful it was coming out. I just wanted that to be an assumption. And that's why it seems so modern now, I think.
It was pretty audacious. I mean, I remember. Well, Bill kept wanting me to have them kissing on stage, and
I'm not sure I did. I think I might have wanted a success more than kissing on stage.
Well,
at that time,
you did want kissing on stage, which I have nothing against. But at that time, I thought we're already in so many people's faces. You know, the first number is four Jews in a room bitching. So you had the Jews who make up all of New York theater. They were
who don't know I'm Jewish,
and then
and are very offended.
Yes, they think he's Irish. So that you got letters. How dare you write about Jews that way? And people angry and walking out. And then you've got, you know, heteros who are suddenly realizing it's a show about a guy who's been married and leaves his wife and child for another man. So I mean, there were a lot of, you know, we really pressed a lot of buttons, and but it had a kind of it was in a little theater. We had like sometimes midnight shows. It was very, though it wasn't downtown, but it was interesting that to look back on it now, and now you see the guys naked in bed and they kiss and everything, and nobody bats an eyelash. But back then it was...
They hoot and holler now.
What?
They kiss in the bed, and we get cheers and whistles from the audience now.
And
from teenage girls.
Sorry. And in Trouts, the original show, has a song called Wizard Going Down about a guy getting a blowjob. And I thought, well, this is the end of my career. And then I thought, well, I don't have a career. So it doesn't much matter.
I'm going to borrow that quote and wake up to it every morning and play Eye of the Tiger. Jordan, in producing the revival and a lot of the questions that I want to ask is how much of the storyline, the narratives kind of fit into your personal lives as well and what you could take out of it. So being that this whole entire show is about, the family unit, the complexities of human relationships, would love to hear your thoughts on how you personally are attached to the revival itself.
Well, so I first encountered Falsettos after all the playwrights productions, and then it was put together for the Broadway production. And I was in my late teens, and I saw it at the Golden Theater, and I thought, that's my life, or what it could be. And it always stayed with me. It was this show and this music, because I just think it's just like what we sound like on the inside. And it buried itself in me, and I grew with it. And then, this one fateful night, I was with Lapine at a dinner. We were talking.
Didn't know each other, really.
Barely knew each other, totally. And he stopped kind of mid-story and said, so what's your bucket list show? And I said, I cannot believe you are asking me this, because it is yours and it is Falsettos. Wow. And it wasn't really a list. It was one. Mm. And it was that. And by that time, I was married with one son, now two sons. And so that hunch I think I had that this could be me was sort of me.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I mean, in some ways, it seems like it's very much a story of a time, but we're almost kind of saying, no, this moves with, people who were not, out and about living open gay lives or even closeted gay lives in the 70s or 80s. I mean, it's a story that worked in 92. It's a story that's working here in 2019. I'm kind of curious, what are you hearing from audiences today, and who is the audience? Are they still... Oh, my God, Bill Finn. He's not Jewish, is he?
I think they figured that out.
They Wikipedia did for.
Totally.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's...
They're younger.
Really?
They are younger.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And really, great theater has something to say to us always. The question, there was that question always of, is this relevant now? And always a story that is true and honest has something to say to us. I'm really actually excited about the next revival. 20 years? 30 years?
We won't be here, but it's up to you.
I'll be here. We'll be here. You'll be
Whenever
here.
Whenever you want.
You'll be here. Come on.
I personally don't think it should ever end. I think it should just keep traveling around.
Oh, even better.
Yeah.
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 Infinite National Tour.
There you go. Yeah. The film version. Who knows? Who knows?
So, Spencer, I mean, we started off talking about the show and its creation. And yes, it touches on some serious topics, but it also is fun and it's funny. And there's a lot that's happening on stage. And so as choreographer, how do you take these stories and then... put people into positions and body language that can translate the heavy stuff to the not so heavy stuff, and then make people feel all these emotions all throughout 2.5 hours.
Well, the emotions are there in the text and in the performances. The show certainly does touch on every emotion, and the whole first act, I mean, it's a roller coaster before you even get to the second act, which is a lot of people sort of equate this show with the AIDS crisis, which actually isn't until the very end of the show. I was not familiar with the show in the way that, you know, all three of these men were. I had the pleasure and the pressure of being the younger, fresh voice that was, I think, James reached out, I think, to have a take on it. The way that we look at theater now, it's everything is staged differently. It's a lot slicker. There's a lot of money in everything. And it was like, how do you take this production that found its legs in this very underground space and put it on Broadway and not forget what it was, but make it, you know, watchable to a modern audience? I think that was a big part of what I did. And then there's no kicks and turns in this show. It doesn't call for that. And it's really about, you know, just trying to support these characters and what they're going through. And the dance actually came very easily when it was time to do steps. We had a brilliant cast of original actors in New York that we found it all in the room. We had four amazing weeks at Lincoln Center and the rehearsal studios to find this show. And the big new part of our show was this actual puzzle piece that was our set, which was all of these different blocks that start in one perfect square, and they get ripped apart throughout the show, and the actors physically have to build the world for each other and rip it down and build up another world. And that allowed us, you know, a way to find the show physically in an entirely new way.
There's so much I'm into it that even as someone who, you know, as a viewer, I had all these questions, like, how did they put this all together? I mean, everybody's mind is so different, but it tells a story so well. John?
Well, actually, I wanted to stay on that. I mean, James, when you started looking for a choreographer, first of all, not being a Broadway person, the director hires the choreographer, am I correct? Or is that...
Yeah, but it's Bill weighs in on it, and Bill knew Spencer's work from television rather well.
I love that. So what is
so
the,
you think
what
you can
is, so you think you can dance? Who's seen that? Spencer choreographs for them.
Did you recommend Spencer?
No, but I also saw his brilliant production of Spring Awakening.
As did I, and that's what
I woke up to an email one morning from James Lapine. Said James Lapine, and that surely can't be the James Lapine I've never met emailing me. And he said, I would love to chat with you. And we had a long conversation,
yeah,
not about the show.
About?
No, never talked about the show. He's great in interviews. He's also great with actors when they come in the room to audition. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot from that. You know, he always asks them, what's your middle name? Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? All these things that, you know, he just wants to know who you are. And so we talked probably two or three times before we ever really dove into what the show was. And then he sent me to Lincoln Center Library, their incredible archive there, and he said, watch the show. And I had done, this was my third revival. I did the revival of Hedwig and Spring Awakening and never went back and looked at the original productions because I didn't want it to weigh on how I saw the show. But he insisted that I go see it, which was great. I fell in love with it. That's how I came on board.
So tonight in San Francisco is the premiere of the Lincoln Center revival, and I'm not sure if anything's changed or has any, like, what does it mean when we say there's a revival, and is the show any different tonight besides cast members?
Well, that's not a small thing, because cast members bring the change to anything you do. You don't ask somebody to come in and give somebody else's performance.
Right.
So this is an extraordinary cast, totally on par with the Broadway cast, but they bring a whole other energy and sensitivity to it and make this a unique production in its way, I would say.
For the sake of not just the folks in the room, but everyone listening to this, let's do, if you will, almost the commercial of how long is it going to be playing? Where can people go to get information on it. Put you on the spot, James?
I have no idea.
It's at the SHN or Golden Gate Theater all through mid-April, I believe.
I believe April 14th.
Yeah.
It plays until the Golden Gate, at the Golden Gate Theater.
Yeah, so go online to SHN Golden Gate.
Yeah. My question was more of who the new cast members are.
Yeah, let's talk about the
and
cast.
The excitement around the cast since they make the show.
Well, they're I could say pretty much people that we all knew from their work in other Broadway shows. And in fact, many of them didn't even audition. We just offered it to people we thought would be really great at it. And they're actors who don't often go out on the road. But the unique thing about the show is they get to play really big parts and sing really great music. And, you know, when you're only one of five in the first act and one of seven in the second, you really have a lot to do. And I think this show offers a unique opportunity for really top-drawer performers to have a chance to dig into something and play it night after night and find things. And they're extraordinary company. But because it's sung through, there's a limited number of people who really can do it because it's vocally
really limited.
and he writes notes that, you know, four people can actually hit. So it's a challenge, but it's a thrill.
So speaking of that, what's also groundbreaking about falsettos is yes, everything is through, you know, songs and singing, and it's somewhat the first of its kind, or it's opened doors for other shows like Dear Evan Hansen and this conversational kind of singing. And so I wanted to ask Bill, I mean, from my perspective, at least in thinking about contemporary shows, and to say that, you know, your show opened up the doors for this format, for this style, and truly, you know, other
It's true, but let's not
stories.
Talk about it.
No, no. I get it.
It's really true. I try to write lyrics that sound like they're just making them up on the spot. And in fact, I got reviewed when I started out, is people said he just makes them up on the spot, obviously, and they're improvised, and which is so untrue. They're very rigorously chosen, and the rhymes are placed throughout the lines. They're not at all improvised, but I'm glad that people thought they were, because that was the intention. Mm-hmm.
They should
have been smart enough to realize they were.
When a play is revived, I mean, do you revisit it and do any?
I revisited this one. For 25 years, or how many years it's been, 35, 40 years, I've been having to go to the show and seeing productions, and I think, oy vey, that's unbelievably bad. and so now I got a chance to fix it. And that was really fun. You know, so I made it much better, I think.
He's talking about the improvisatory lyrics
yes.
that
yes.
he decided to make better.
Yeah, I'm sure some people thought I screwed it up, but I don't.
Nobody thought you screwed it
Whatever.
up.
Whatever. I liked it. I like it much more. This is the version I like. Mm.
Well, we normally open up time with our audience to ask our panelists questions, and so I think we'll do that right now.
I'm curious to know from all the panelists how you feel about the recorded version, like video streaming, of various shows, because I know Falsettos was one of them, so to be able to have captured that particular production versus a live performance, the latter of which I really prefer, but it's nice to be able to have something not just in an archive, but something that is more readily available to the public. Thoughts?
Go ahead.
Nothing can ever replace live theater, but we have to accept that not everybody has access to it. And I think for a show like this, you know, before we knew we were going on a tour, it was a fantastic way of getting it seen by more audience members. I also think that what they did with Falsettos was, it's one of the best that they have filmed. They really respected the story. They were wide when they needed to be wide as the choreographer. They so often cut in tight and you miss things. And they understood that the transitions were so part of the storytelling. They left all that in. And then you got the added benefit of getting really in close for some close-ups, and you could see choices with the performers that enhanced their performances beyond what you could see, you know, from afar. But I was proud of what they did with the film. I'm so glad it existed, and you should still absolutely come out and see this production live, because if you have the opportunity, that's what this show is meant to be. It's how it should be experienced.
I have to ask, how do you feel, because I've talked to musicians about this, and they actually have conflicting views on it. How do you feel about the people who are sitting in the audience filming you?
I love that.
You do? Seriously?
You get a version that you sometimes don't see otherwise, even for me.
Actors don't love it. It's not the way to do it. But, you know, and they're, the argument is there. They're like, well, not everyone can see it, and people should be able to. And, you know, and the ticket prices are very high, and they do keep some people from getting to see it. But that, the illegal version is not. What you should do is support those streaming sites so that they can properly film more shows. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, and it's distracting when people are in the audience bringing out their cameras and filming things. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but some things are changed, and they're getting things in a different version that you would forget otherwise.
I think also
I'm talking from a writer's view.
I think also there's a difference between the bootleg and taking a photograph of something which has become a very meaningful way in which we process our experiences now. For better or worse.
I'm talking about bootlegs.
I get it. But I think, you know, it's a wide-ranging conversation. And that is a thing that we've really had to grapple with in the theater. Because it for many years was no pictures, no video, no nothing. We'll literally cut your arms off. And there was a switch. This switch of sort of recognizing what taking a picture or taking a short video has come to mean in our world, and how much that is a way in which we truly connect to the thing that we're doing. And so in a lot of our shows now, we even have inserts in the programs that say, please enjoy the show. You'll have an opportunity at the curtain call to take a picture. And that's all people want to know, is that this whole experience won't pass me by without getting to process it in a way that has come to be very meaningful. And that really is about balancing what I think James and Spencer are talking about, this sort of sanctity of the experience, with recognizing that if the theater is to be part of the modern culture, it has to allow for ways in which we engage in the modern culture.
The playbill snapshot picture that goes on Instagram is also a huge marketing tool. With a show that's just getting going, you want those people to tag your show and post that picture of the playbill or the bows. So many theaters do now allow that, and I absolutely agree with you, Jordan.
The Instagrammable set as you come into the theater is now something a lot of people think about. Because we're recognizing that this is how audiences are engaging. And so if we're part of that conversation, that has to be in our design brain. And let me tell you, when you come to Falsettos, it's a very Instagrammable opening moment.
How did what you do as a choreographer differ from the first production?
Well, it was James Lapine was the choreographer of the first version. Mm-hmm. So I had big shoes.
I'm not a choreographer, believe me. That's the difference. We had a choreographer.
One of the first things I said to him, if you saw the original production, everything was on wheels, but it was like revolutionary at the time that he put all this furniture on wheels, and that was, you know, and it all moved so quickly. The show moves at such a fast pace. So I think one of the first things I said was, I will do it, but nothing can be on wheels, because instantly then you're going to get compared to, and you're going to be stuck in a place of, well, we did this then, and I, you know. So when we met with Rockwell and came up with this set design, I thought, well, what? It was an incredible way to keep it as an actor-driven set that had nothing to do with wheeling stuff around. So while it was terrifying and very complicated to figure out those block moves, it allowed us, I think, it was the perfect solution. And then we did dance a little more than they did in the original production.
Definitely. Probably
they certainly didn't. It was fabulous.
You like
it? And it was based on like the what's the Jewish singing?
We did a lot of Jewish dancing references, yes, in this show. But it was, you know, I didn't feel pressure. I felt a lot of support from
from James and Bill and the boys at Lincoln Center and who had done it originally, there was a lot of people in the room watching me choreograph that were part of the original production. But it wasn't anything ever, but just, you know, they were happy to have a fresh pair of eyes on it, I think.
Going back to the choreography part of it, did you have in the rehearsal room prototypes of the block?
But we had the real thing. But we didn't meet that block until I think 2 days before the cast came, because it, you know, had to get built, and right. We had no idea what it would feel like or weigh like, or I mean, it was a big question. And we sat in the room. We tried to do it with a little model, because they gave us this tiny little model, and we sat there for 2 days, tiny little blocks, making what we thought all the pieces would be. We'd said we need a couch looking block and a triangle, and the triangle can be the end table. And I don't think any of that stuff lasted. It wasn't until we had the massive piece, and he's such a great architectural mind, and so we'd make these sculptures of what it would be. And then he'd be like, all right, you know, figure out how to get it there. Go to lunch. And then
it was a lot of higher math. But we did, in the design, know what we needed the pieces to do. But they also couldn't be large because people had to carry them. Right. So, you know, when you make a couch, it couldn't be a real couch. It had to be pieces that became a couch. And I loved it. I mean, I have to say, it was fun. And it was also, he really was the one that had to do the heavy lifting, though, you know.
Literally.
You made the actors, like from day one, though, you sort of said, you're all going to do these blocks, and it doesn't matter if you just belted your face off for 5 minutes, you're going to push that block across the stage so that that guy can sing his song. And it just, like, even the playing field to make nobody could be the star. Everybody had to participate. Everybody had to haul things around. And it was such a fantastic way of just having
this production, the actors never left the stage either, which was not the case in the first production. So
hidden
it was very organic, you know. It was really a box within a box, and it was fun.
Yeah,
I didn't have to.
Well, kudos to your producer for giving you that access to them early on, because a tape out is never the same.
Yeah, you would never. We had to have them. Thank
you. Anyone? Another question?
Two gentlemen in the middle. Where did you grow up?
New York City.
I moved to New York when I was 9. I lived there since then. I was a kid actor.
And where did you make your professional debut?
The very first time I was ever on a stage was at the Golden Gate Theater in 1992 with the Will Rogers Follies. So to have the show open there tonight.
At what age?
7 years old. It was my first job. And my father just sent me a picture of me from opening night on the staircase in the Golden Gate Theater at 7. Mm-hmm. So I'll go recreate that photo later today.
Isn't that amazing?
You know, what's interesting is it's tradition on this show, actually, when we open up, that we always share a coming out story, whatever that is. And we ask everyone, allies, LGBTQ, playwrights, directors, scientists, and everybody has a different way of accepting that question. And John and I were talking in the green room, and I said, I'm going to ask that question because, we're probably all so diverse, and there's four panelists. I don't know if they really want to answer that. But as we find in the audience, it's always an interest to know where did you get your start? Where did you grow up? Who are you? I wanted to ask Bill his coming out story, but I don't know if he wants to share it.
I came out in San Francisco, in Berkeley, actually. After college, I was hired to write a show in Berkeley, and things happened and it didn't work out. And so I was living on Milvia Avenue in a rundown boarding house. And I'd been going to therapy in San Francisco. And one night I went to a gay bar, and the next day I came into San Francisco, and I said to my therapist, I guess we're finished. It's time to move back to New York. I guess that's why I came out. I had no idea why. But that's what I'm doing out here.
And then did you tell your folks right away?
I did, right away.
What was...
And my mother said, why did you need the therapist, which they were paying for? And I said, you don't want to know. And she said, you're gay. I said, yeah, and I don't want any scenes. And so that was with my mother, and my father just was very nice about the whole thing.
But do you think your mother knew you were gay?
No, I don't know. I kind of told her why I wanted to go to a therapist, and she said, why? On the phone. And I said, you don't want to know. And so that was my thing.
I think parents know, personally.
They know-ish.
My own.
Oh, yeah.
Denial is a very
know-ish.
Well, that's probably true, too. But they still know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I was a little dancing 7-year-old who dressed up in the Chorus Girls outfits in Will Rogers Follies. And I came out to my mom at 15, and she truly was just, it was really surprised.
Really?
Like, are you kidding me? But it was not, you know, I always thought my mother would be so fine with it, and I was scared at telling my dad. It was the exact opposite. My mom had a really hard time with it. My dad, I think the first thing he said was, I will be happy to walk you down the aisle no matter who you love or want to marry. I love
That's
you.
Nice.
I mean, it was like the best thing. I will say to parents, the first words you say to your child after they come out are the most important thing. You could screw up your relationship with them forever. It took my mom and I years to recover from the first words.
Because you're young, you know. I would think, you know, Bill and I are of the older generation.
Wait, do you have a coming out story, James?
I don't, because I didn't really come out. But I kind of was sort of a hippie, kind of anything goes kind of guy for, you know, in my 20s. And just ended up with a woman. But, you know, maybe if I had met a man that I completely adored or somehow, I just sort of believe in the fluidity of today's world, right, too. I think, but I think everybody's wired differently. Do you know? Some people are wired in very specific ways, and other people are not. And I wouldn't say I was, you know, I work in the musical theater. I mean, everybody thinks I'm gay anyway, which is fine. I couldn't care less. And I think it's just finding your soul. For me, it's finding a soulmate, you know.
Yep.
At the end of the day,
I find falsettos to be all of everything that you could possibly learn in your human sexualities class, and you know, packed in a Broadway show and 2.5 hours. So
that's going to be our new ad.
Yeah.
No, but I think, you know, if Marvin had come of age in a different era, you know, he might not, you know, might have been open with his wife before he got, you know, it might have been a different scenario. And I think men at that time, and women too, did what they thought was expected of them, and they got married or they had children or whatever, and discovered later in life that really wasn't where they wanted to live. But as you say, you know, everybody's story is unique in a way.
It is. So
what's your story?
Yeah, exactly. We've got to hear from Jordan, then we'll swing back to our audience.
So I first came out in college. I was a sophomore in college. And I think I say first came out because coming out is something you do constantly. About all kinds of things. My husband and I went to Virginia, where our son was to be born, and we were in this small town, not so small, but
small enough.
And we were checking into the hotel, and the woman at the desk was like, "So what are you doing here?" And I literally froze, and I thought, "Oh God, do I say what we're doing here?" And I was like, "Yeah. This is the most extraordinary experience, and I'm not going to cover it or lie about it or feel weird about it." And I said, "We're here to have a baby." And this could have gone in any number of directions. And she was like, "That's fantastic. Are you having a boy or a girl?" I said, "We're having a boy." She said, "I have 4 boys. How wonderful." And, you know, I think about it a lot because it was really a lesson for me that letting people be wonderful, giving people the opportunity to be wonderful, is something we don't always do. And her being able to give me that required my coming out to her. And it's a thing we do all the time.
It's beautiful. It's exactly how I feel.
How about you, Meow? Meow. As long as we're going down the list here. You know.
Does that mean I get some alone time with the four big talents? Because my story is really long.
Oh, yes. It sounds like you were born of a different culture too, with your mom and
born and raised, born in Whittier, and then grew up in Stockton, California. It's an all American city before you say anything, or it was in 2008. But it's 80 miles east of San Francisco, and lots of gang activity. I guess the average income is like $35,000, something like that, per household. And so, coming out to my mom, a single parent who raised five kids on her own after immigrating to the United States, and her husband dying, abruptly of a cerebral aneurysm, my mom really thought that the ticket to a good life in America was going to be me. This when I was not out yet,
Where are you in
hair.
The five?
Number three. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the middle. But I'm the eldest of the three girls. We have two older brothers, and so my mom was banking on me. Perfect looking angel, straight A's, long jet black dark hair, slender, blunt bangs, super quiet and obedient. So my mom was like, "This is it. We're gonna make it in America. She's gonna marry a doctor or a lawyer, but one of the two." And I didn't. So coming out to her, that's going to be a book or a show one day. Maybe. Yeah. But we have an audience here. Who want to hear from you four?
We have another question here, sir. Oh.
So first of all, I'm going to have to go back to 1992 and look at my Will Rogers Hawley's program and see if I saw you in that production.
You would have.
I'm pretty sure I saw it here in San Francisco. And Michelle, you just did a number on the 209. Stockton is really a beautiful city.
Right.
People should know that the Valley is a rich place. My question has to do with the difference between the show back in its original incarnation and now. And I know I saw that original show, and I probably saw it on the touring version when it was here in San Francisco or when it did California at some point in time. I know I didn't see it in New York. And I remember thinking back that the show was pretty white. But this show, I saw it last night, and I was so pleased to see that there was a person of color in your cast. And then I was fiddling around online, and apparently in New York, you also cast a person of color in the show. And I wonder if that was intentional and if that's the way you intend it to be cast going forward. I know it's always a director's preference about what they choose to do. Sometimes non-traditional casting can upset the flow of a show. This doesn't seem to be at all. I was pleased to see that the woman was there, but nothing was made of the fact that she was a person of color. She was just part of this constructed family. And the other question I had is an aside from that is like, why are you all here? I didn't know that these people traveled with a show. So I'm a little bit surprised that you're here for this show.
We all love this show. That's why we're here. This is our official opening. So we're here to celebrate that. We've done a few cities on the way, like test cities. And this is where we're really putting it out there for the world. But you answer the first question.
Well, I think, we live in a time where we want to be. Not necessarily to do shows that are open to people of all colors and backgrounds and whatnot. So yeah, we did make an effort, and we thought that role made sense. And we talked about Whizzer being black, but we didn't actually.
Whizzer has been black in the past.
Yeah, it's always an interesting question because. This is not a new thing, actually, although it's very much in the zeitgeist now, but Actors Equity, and we've always tried to open up shows. It's hard when you do a new show because it can be confusing to an audience to see a black person in a role that wasn't really written in any particular way, and then they'll believe that it's written for, but I think audiences in New York are particularly used to not really making any distinction like that. So, it wasn't a huge deal, but there's so many wonderful actors and actresses around. We had the boy on the tour was Asian. was from Korea, who played the bar mitzvah boy, who happened to actually be Jewish because he was adopted by a Jewish family. So, you know, it's just...
And he was really good.
He was good. Yeah. His voice changed.
Unfortunately, he hit puberty midway across America and couldn't hit any of the notes anymore.
They rewrote the whole show for him.
Yeah. So anyway, so kind of like that. But I think that's the world we're living in now, that the stage has to reflect the people in our world.
And you'd much rather see a multi-culti sort of show.
Yep.
I mean, you just would. It's more fun. It's like alive.
Sadly, are running out of time with our great, great panelists, our guests here today who are giving us the wonderful falsettos opening up tonight in San Francisco. I just very quickly, and it's the last question for all four of you, and it's a quick answer, but it kind of wraps up everything that we've been talking about. And right now, it's just such an odd time in which our identities are being used against us. We're being categorized in places we don't want to be categorized. But falsettos, even though, you know, the first Broadway show was 1992, it's timeless, and it also brings out these emotions of a lot of things, of strength, of hope, and we can make family, and family relationships can heal. And so I do think that our time now can heal. If you could give us just a couple words of what you want people to take out of it or why they should go see it tonight, let us know. James, I'll start with you.
Well, you should see it because it's fun. It's really a good show, and it's got extraordinary score by this guy down here, and incredible performers. So let's just start there. If you love theater, you'll love the show. And I think I don't ever believe in preaching to an audience. I think every audience member will walk away with something personal that speaks to them. And I think that any good piece of theater doesn't have one message. It has many messages depending on who's watching it.
Spencer.
Million stories. Love is at the heart of this show, love and family. But for me, we judge ourselves so harshly and sometimes hate our flaws. And these characters are beautifully flawed. And I think that's what so many people can relate to. And you can see them accepting their flaws in each other for them and finding their happiness therein. That's what you can take away.
That's where I connect too. It's these are complicated people, messy, gloriously messy, just like us.
There are people trying not to be dicks, and they all are.
Another new ad.
All right. Thank you, James, Spencer, you. Jordan, Bill, for all being here at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to you all,
for
being here and supporting us.